Why the slow, sad version of Elaine's theme? Well, it's wholly appropriate, dear listener, to tonight's programme, because it's a tale of immense human drama, of survival, and loss on a scale difficult to comprehend. We're going to tell you the story of the world's worst maritime disaster, the greatest loss of life in a single vessel. As one of my guests has written, the tragedy of the Titanic was but a whisper in the wind by comparison. What makes the story more remarkable is that most of us haven't heard of it, for it remains 60 years after the fact, a little told story, in that sense absolutely dwarfed by the Titanic. You know, the contrast couldn't be greater, the Titanic on a glitzy maiden voyage, much of a human cargo made up of the privileged, bound for a grand reception in New York. 1,500 people drowned when the Titanic hit that famous iceberg. But the sinking we're talking about tonight was no accident. Those on board were mostly refugees, mostly children. There were no orchestras in the ship's grand ballrooms. All available space was taken up by mattresses and sleeping bags. The Wilhelm Gustloff was one of the prides and joys of Nazi Germany, a cruise ship named after a Hitler protégé. And she was absolutely crammed with passengers, all of them fleeing the advancing Russian army right at the end of World War II. The ship was sunk by three torpedoes from a Russian submarine in the southern Baltic Sea. It was just after 9 p.m. on January the 30th, 1945, in the middle of winter. Of the estimated 9,000 to 10,000, and perhaps more on board, just over 1,000 people survived. The rest went down with the ship to die in the freezing Baltic Sea. Now, we'll find out why this remains such a little-known story, as told by three survivors of the tragedy, and an historian whose book on the subject is yet to be published in English. Before we meet them, however, we're going to visit the wreck, as she is today, with the help of a British diver and deep-sea photographer, Lee Bishop, who was part of an officially sanctioned dive to the site of the wreck in 2003. Lee Bishop, welcome to the programme. Could you start by telling us where the wreck is and what sort of conditions it's in after 60 years at the bottom of the Baltic?
Okay, Philip, good evening to you. Yes, the wreck actually lies off of the north port of Gdansk, just around the corner from the Bay of Danzig, northern Poland in the Baltic Sea. She basically lies on a port side. She appears intact, very much so at the stern and bow sections of the wreck, then extensively damaged amidships, quite possibly made worse through evidence of salvage on site. Much of her teak decking remains in excellent condition, more so at the stern, like I said, where the poop deck overhangs what could be classed as a wonderful counter stern, remaining in absolute remarkable condition. It's here as well that you can see the stern safety rail, which is amazingly intact, with its original and delicately carved wooden top rail. One of the most fascinating sights on the wreck is found actually behind the counter stern here. On the starboard side, just below the safety rail, is the iron letters spelling the word Wilhelm Gustloff. It can clearly be seen in large Gothic letters.
Now, when you say clearly seen, you mean just that, don't you? Because the water is eerily transparent.
It is. It's fantastic conditions up there in the Baltic Sea. And seeing things like those letters gives a seriously haunting sight of this once proud ship. When the ship was afloat, there was a small exterior staircase that led down to the poop deck that I talk about, where passengers could traverse to two different deck levels. This staircase is still in place today, along with its topside safety rail. And below, to the right, is where passengers would have stepped down onto the poop deck. Various machinery sits firm to the deck. It's a fantastic sight, it really is.
Any sight of human remains?
Our team never actually saw any human remains. Doesn't mean to say that there aren't any there. We didn't penetrate the ship as such on our dives to the wreck. It's not until you know and understand the wreck that you would consider making penetrations as opposed to exterior photography. I have had letters from other international divers around the world that have witnessed human remains on the wreck.
Let's go back to something you did see, and that's clear evidence of looting. Now, the Polish authorities are strict on policing divers at the site, but you saw lots of sites of plunder. Hardly surprising, is it, Lee, when I understand someone will pay up to $10,000 for an ashtray marked with the ship's insignia?
Well, I could quite imagine that would be the case. The Polish do take the wreck incredibly serious now. But we did see signs of damage to the wreck. The amidship section of the ship is extensively damaged. The anchors have gone. One of the propellers is gone, which shows you that whoever's been there doing a salvage job has taken those to kind of pay for the job itself. And I spoke to local Polish people when I was in the area, and they all tell me that at one point in time the Soviets did visit the wreck, quite possibly in search of the famous amber room that was said to be on the wreck. There's no evidence, realistically, that the amber room was on the wreck, but the Soviets have almost certainly been there. Whether they were looking for the amber room that was stolen by the Nazis, I don't know. We didn't find any evidence of it either.
I guess on the day of your dive, during springtime, it was hard to imagine that freezing night in January 1945.
It was. My main focus of attention was that of stills photography. But I have to say, there are places, identifiable places, like that wonderful preserved deck. It makes you sort of freeze a moment for a time and just imagine how many people was actually standing there. I think we talked about human remains, but I have to say, just being on the surface of that spot in the Baltic Sea is an incredible presence, something that bad that happened there. I've dived hundreds and hundreds of shipwrecks over the years, and I've only ever felt that presence in one other place, and that was on the Titanic site. It's extremely cold in the Baltic Sea, even at the time of year we dived. And while you're waiting to be picked up in the water, you can't help but think of the thousands of people that were concentrated in that area. You notice I say the word think as opposed to imagine, simply because it's not possible for me to even begin to imagine what it could have actually been like to have been there. Of course, I've got a modern-day thermal exposure suit on, what I use for diving, and I could last for hours in the water, but I wouldn't think for 1 minute that I'd last very long like those people did in January 1945.
Vivid words from Lee Bishop, but Lee, I understand that listeners can see your vivid photographs. Can you tell them how to do it?
That's right. The results of this expedition can be found on www.deepimage.co.uk. And I'll also be covering the wreck as part of a Lost Liners presentation on the 12th and 13th of March at the Australian Technology Park in Sydney as part of the Diving Technologies Conference.
Lee, thank you very much for your contribution. This is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. Before I introduce the three survivors who are guests on the program, I want to tell a little of the history of the ship and what was happening at the time she embarked on that fateful journey. And to help in this respect, we welcome Klaas Gorin Vetterholm, who's a shipping historian who's written extensively about the Wilhelm Gustloff and about several other maritime disasters in the Baltic at around the same time. And to put this in context, a week after the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff, the Steuben was sunk by the same Soviet submarine with a death toll of 4,500. A ship called the Goya sank with 6,000, so you've got over 20,000 people drowned in the Baltic at more or less the same time. And later we might be able to also factor in the tragic story of survivors of a concentration camp who also went down. Little wonder that Klaas calls his book Sea of Death. It was published in Swedish in 2003, and we hope to encourage an Australian publisher to come up with an Australian or an English translation. Klaas joins us from a Radio Sweden studio in Stockholm. Klaas, I didn't know the story of the ship, but I do remember a little of the story of Wilhelm Gustloff, because he was not simply a protege of Hitler, he was regarded as a martyr to the cause. Can you tell us about him?
Well, he was actually building up a Swiss Nazi organization And there was a Jewish student who had actually emigrated to Switzerland or took off to Switzerland. His name was David Frankfurter. And he had been following Wilhelm Gustloff in the papers. And he was more or less obsessed by this man because he realized that Gustloff would build up the same kind of organization in Switzerland as had Hitler had done in Germany. And he had come to Switzerland in 1933. And in 1936, he took off with the train in Davos. That's where Gustloff was living. He booked into a hotel, and then he walked over to Gustloff's house and called the door. And Mrs. Gustloff opened the door. Wilhelm Gustloff was talking over the phone. So Frankfurter just waited in Gustloff's study. And when he entered, he was a tall guy, 190 centimeters tall, so he was a big guy. But Frankfurter had no fear whatsoever, so he just pulled up a gun and shot Gustloff with 5 shots. And Gustloff died immediately.
I understand that he then surrendered to the police. He was imprisoned in Switzerland and released after the war.
He was silently, so to speak, released after the war, yes. But he was a good friend of Gustloff, so he wanted to make a big propaganda show out of this. And to cut the story very short, the ship, the first of the big tourist organization, Kraft durch Freude, which is strength through joy, the first ship that was launched for this organization was to be called Hitler, but Hitler himself changed the name to Wilhelm Gustloff. So that's the story in short.
And Gustloff's widow baptizes the ship.
Yeah, she baptized the ship, but Hitler, of course, was there to hold a big speech of the ship. And it was a remarkable ship because she was a one-class ship. So she had the same kind of cabins, the same size, and they were all facing the sea, not only for the passengers, but also for the crew.
There were two suites, though, weren't there? Yeah, one correct. For Hitler and one for...
Robert Ley, who started this organization. But this was quite remarkable for the time that there was a ship like that. And it was fairly cheap to go on the ship. It cost around about 1 week's salary to go on the ship. And if you had a vacation, your salary, of course, would be paid. So it became immensely popular very, very soon.
Now, during the war, she worked as a hospital ship briefly, didn't she? But I understand she'd been sitting idle for about 4 years, docked in Gotenhaven.
Yes, in Gotenhaven. So that's where she stayed. So a ship must move, a ship must be used. So it was a sort of a tired lady that was suddenly made ready for this big evacuation. Then the Soviet Red Army had begun its campaign and invaded the eastern part of Germany. And they soon cut off the land roads. And so the only way of rescuing people and military staff was over the Baltic. And this is the greatest evacuation at sea that ever has taken place. Over 2 million people survived.
Heavens above.
And you can find in the Hitler's headquarters that when these ships went down, because it did happen then, that they said that, well, it's a pity, but this is something we have to count with, and it's sad, but we have to carry on. So they just noted it and carried on the evacuation. They also evacuated the concentration camps. So at the same time as ordinary Germans were evacuated, people, concentration camp prisoners, were towed in barges over the Baltic to be collected, and many of them later on ended up on these two ships, Kapalkona and Tilbeck. And they were, as far as we know, accidentally bombed on the 3rd of May, 1945. And you must remember the war ended officially 7th of May. So there was somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000 people packed on these two ships, and they were bombed by RAF. It is more or less an unknown story that this did happen. It was a horrible, horrible mistake. And the pilots were using a new kind of phosphor bombs, so the ships burned from top and down.
Let's now introduce Eva Rothschild, who's speaking to us from her home in Switzerland. Now, in January 1945, Eva was 18 years old. She was a keen music student. She'd been drafted into the German Navy the day after her 17th birthday, and she was stationed for over a year in that port city where the Wilhelm Gustloff was berthed. And with the Russians approaching, Eva, I understand you had a choice to stay and fight or flee. Did you consider staying to fight?
No, we had never considered that. All the girls who were there, we didn't consider to stay there. I mean, we saw the Russians coming already, the artillery on the horizon. You know, there was already the light and the noise of the artillery. So we said, we are going.
And, of course, there are also the stories of the Red Army, wasn't there? The stories of their treatment of German women.
So we were very, very happy to go on the Gustloff.
How did you get your boarding ticket, Eva?
Oh, we got this from the military, from the other part of the Navy. We were there in a barn. We were in a barn, and there somebody came in and gave us the tickets. It was very cold and miserable.
And you're one of 1,200 other naval women who get the boarding ticket. Yeah. And you're shown, all of you are shown to a particular part of the ship. And it was a place that made you feel uncomfortable. Tell us why.
We were shown the swimming pool. As I went down to the swimming pool and I looked at it, and it was crowded with other girls. And I thought, no, that's nothing for me. If something should ever happen down there, I would be lost. And I was right. None of them. I think one girl went to safety. The others all drowned because there the torpedoes came in.
Mm. You went upstairs to a big ballroom where there were lots of mattresses and people sitting around doing nothing, waiting.
But doing nothing is not for me. I was there a week before we left. And, you know, there was just laying around and doing nothing. And so I went to the reception there where all the people came in. And I saw that people, it was horrible. I cannot describe it. They came by sled with grandmother and newborn babies born on the sled and dead babies in their arms and little children with deep frost bites in their cheeks. So I went to the lazarette, to the hospital, and asked for some ointment, you know, something, and they gave me some Vaseline. So I gave every child a slap on their cheeks with the Vaseline. But then we ran out of Vaseline, but I didn't want to go back to where all the others were, and I had a girlfriend of mine, she was with me, a comrade, and we went to the hospital and helped there.
But you also helped with the delivery of two babies, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And, and this is another story. I was in the room of the doctor, and I watched there the birth of the baby, but it wasn't born. Just the head showed. And she came in and she said, "Doctor, the head is showing," and at this moment the torpedo came.
Mm.
And this woman came on a stretcher into a boat, and she delivered later on her baby on the mine boat Löwe. And the other babies, I don't know where they are. I mean, it's...
Mm. Let's now introduce Horst Voigt, who was speaking to us from his home in Canada. He was 10 years old at the time. His mother and he, along with a family friend and her daughter, fled from East Prussia and managed to make their way to the ship. Horst, would you tell us what you had in your pocket on that journey? Because it turned out to be a lifesaver.
Yes, on the 27th of January, we got permission to flee the city of Elbing. That's where I lived. And my mum ran over to her girlfriend to discuss how we're going to flee, because the Russians were marching into town. And while she was doing that, I went to my uncle's trunk. He had stored a summer uniforms in our apartment, and on top of the trunk there was a Boy Scout knife, which I stole it.
But now, we'll tell the listener why that knife was important later. But I want to go back to something you said. Given permission to leave. I understand the permission was given by members of Hitler Youth. Without that permission, you had to stay there.
Yeah, you couldn't just flee. You had to have permission to flee. Yeah.
Mm. Now, you boarded the boat some days before it sailed. Can you remember what you were feeling as a 10-year-old boy?
Well, when you're 10 years old and you get dropped off on the harbor and you look at this big ship, you're actually astonished about the big size of it. I've never seen a ship that big. And when you looked around on the other side, you could see the other steamers like the Deutschland and the Hansa, and they were all parked there. As a matter of fact, I was there last August the 4th, in Ingedinga, and I looked at, and my tears were just running. I can still see the emotional part of it. The only proud difference was when we were there on 27th of January. It was gray and cold, and you had the feeling of like you're fleeing, you're pushed, there were lineups, you had to get permission to get on the boat, you had to line up in the barrack to get cards to get onto the ship. And once you got onto the ship, you were guided into a dance hall. Of course, all the furniture were taken out. There were just mattresses on the floor, and you made your home there, and you got cards, meal cards, so that you can get your pea soup and whatever they served you. So I was busy for being 10 years old. Actually, it was an adventure rather than a fleeing from the Russian army.
Well, let's now talk to a little girl. Well, now no longer a little girl, but I'm looking at a photograph of her when she's about 2. And she's there with a pusher, a little pram, beside a very young mother. And to our astonishment, we found this little girl is living in Melbourne. Her name is Inga Rodecker. She was 2 in January 45, so she can't remember much of the events, but she knows her mother's story very well, because until the day she died, her mum, Milda, had never been able to share her story with another survivor, but she had shared it. She had shared it with her daughter. Inga, you wouldn't have been on board if your mum had not persuaded the ship's purser to provide tickets for you, as well as her parents and 2 other friends.
That's correct.
How did she persuade them?
Well, she said that she needed 6 tickets, 2 for us and 2 for her elderly parents and for their 2 elderly friends. And the purser said, oh, 2 productive against 4 unproductive people. No, we can't issue passes like that. And Mum said, well, in that case, if we can't all go, then none of us will go. And obviously that swayed him, and he issued 6 passes.
It was a very daring bluff in a way, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Mm. Your mum got the tickets, you get on board. It
yes.
was very crowded, wasn't it? And your mum describes a woman she met on the ship who seemed to be prescient, who seemed to know what was going to happen.
Yeah, she was very preoccupied with something, and my mother said she was restless. She was walking up and down, and said, no, I don't think I'll stay here. And then just before the ship left, she got off the ship. So obviously, Mum said she didn't see her get back on, and that probably wouldn't have been time anyhow. But she didn't do the journey.
I've been reading your mother's story, and of course there's intimations of what's going to happen on the second night. There's that air raid warning, and many, including all of you, leave the ship for an air raid shelter.
Yes, yes.
This is LNL on Radio National, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web, and tonight we're revisiting the world's worst maritime disaster, the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff. Back to you, Klaus. The Wilhelm Gustloff finally sailed at lunchtime on the 30th of January, and at the same time, a maverick Russian submarine captain is steering his sub towards the heavily overloaded ship, although he didn't know what he was going to come across, did he?
No, he didn't. He actually didn't follow the orders of his superiors. Marinescu was his name. And by then, the Russians had naval bases in, among other places, in Turku, Obo, as we call it in Swedish. And he worked from there. So the submarine was to leave from there. But when everything was ready and the crew was aboard the submarine, Marinescu himself was gone, and they couldn't find him. And 3 days later, he appeared, and he had been drinking too much and spent 3 days and nights in a brothel in Turku.
He was almost court-martialed, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. But his crew appealed to him so that he should go. And finally they left. And he wasn't actually supposed to be outside the Danzig Bay area. There is a lot of confusion in the whole story because the reason for Marinescu seeing Wilhelm Gustloff was actually that on board the ship they had four captains. And there was a big confusion with these four people. The superior captain decided they had to put lanterns out in order not to collide with a convoy that they were supposedly meeting, although there was no convoy coming. And Marinescu saw these lanterns. He saw the lights. And they were not out for a very, very long time, but he could see them. And then he started following the ship. And when he got the best shooting range, he fired three torpedoes.
Do we know whether he was familiar with the ship? Would he have known it was crammed with refugees, with children?
With all the hate that had been building up throughout the war, I don't think he would have cared. Later on, Heinz Schön, who is the great historian of the Wilhelm Gustloff, had met the man who shot the torpedoes and explained to him that the ship was packed with women and children, and the man couldn't believe it, and said that if I'd known that, I wouldn't have shot the torpedoes. But I think that's nonsense, because you follow orders,
yeah,
and you do as you're told in war.
And, of course, they would have regarded the occupants, in fact any German, as being loyal to Hitler, and thus a legitimate target.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they did.
Now, the same captain, Marinescu, sinks the Steuben 10 days later. So here's this one fellow who's responsible for the worst and the third worst maritime tragedy in history.
It's quite remarkable. And when he returned to Turku, his superiors did not believe him. And his life was, after that, quite tragic. And he actually ended up in the Gulag archipelago, and came back when he was dying in cancer. And it was actually only after his death that he was regarded as a Soviet naval hero. And there is a statue of him now, today, in Russia.
Eva, let's go back to you. It's 9:15 at night. It's very cold. There are thousands of seasick passengers. What do you remember from the time the torpedoes hit the ship?
I was at this room, and then the girl came in, the nurse, and said that the baby's head is showing. Then the first torpedo came. I went to the door, and the door didn't open. Then by the second torpedo, it was 1.5 seconds later, and then the door opened.
Mm.
And in front of the door, there was a casket of some glass, and there was a skeleton in it. And it fell right in front of the door, and I looked at it, and I stepped over it, and I said, okay, I stepped over death. And this thought was with me all the time, and I think that it helped me to keep calm. And then I went down, there were a few stairs, and in this where the safety boats were, and then I helped, because everybody in uniform was supposed to help with women and children. And so I helped women and children within the boats, and I saw the one boat which was frozen on one side and the other side was loose, and all the people in the boat went down into the water. And so I was a little bit scared to go into a boat, but then one of the soldiers told me, so now, girl, it's your way, now you go in too. And so I went into the safety boat and I landed safely on the water. Everything was just falling down from the ship. And I had a girl and a boy next in my arms. And then nobody used the rudder, the steering gear, you know. How do you call it?
The tiller, yeah.
The tiller, right. So, and I was told to take the tiller now. I had the tiller under my left arm, holding tight, straight, and the two in my arms. And then we had people coming and holding on to the boat, trying to get in, but they didn't let them in because they were afraid that we would sink because it was so crowded on the
ship. So that, what, they were beaten back, they were pushed away from the boat.
Yes, but there's faces, which, especially one which I could paint, which I could never forget in my whole life. So we went, and then a ship came, and so we went in this direction. It was very late at night. Then they took the people in, you know, and was, but I was the last in the boat because of the rudder, and I was afraid that I couldn't make it. And there was a woman in the water which was dead, and she was always, with every wave, she knocked on the wall of the ship, this two with a white face and her black hair all around. So they took me in, and I went down into the machine room, which was nice and warm, and they took off our frozen clothes and mine too. And then I tried to look for people which I know. And I found one of our doctors from the hospital, and he was there, and he was sitting there and crying. And because he, oh, 1 second, hold on. He traveled with his wife, who was 7 months pregnant, and she didn't want to jump into the water, so he pushed her. And he jumped after her, and he saw that she drowned. So his Mary was dead. But the next day, as we were saved, you know, on land, then I thought, I have to go and visit him. And I went visit him, and I went up there where he was, and he was standing in the room, his arms wide spread, and said, Eva, my Mary is alive. They had they made a date during the war that if ever they should be separated, they would call a friend in Stralsund. He was a doctor too. And they called both in there, and there they found each other again.
Let's go to Horst in Toronto. Now is, I think, the time for you to tell the story about your pocket knife, Horst. But you're sent to bed that night with your life jacket on, and your mother wakes you.
Yeah, the unwritten law was that you had to go to bed with your life jackets on. So when Mum shook me, that was after the first torpedo hit. Of course, I was asleep, so I didn't realize that what's happening. And then, of course, I heard these second and the third torpedoes hit the boat. Being dressed, it wasn't hard to get out of the cabin, which was on top of the ship. As a matter of fact, we had to go down to the lifeboats, where the majority of people, of course, were all below deck and died, as you know. We got out of the cabin and had to make our way up one set of flights of stairs. The problem we had was that because of the detonation, the fire extinguishers went all loose, and all that foam was all over the stairs. So I made it up to the stairs, and my mom did, and then fell down all the way down to the bottom. And I'm standing on top there, and I'm screaming. But Mom did get the railing and pulled herself up again, and then we went outside. When we were outside, we had to look down onto the lifeboats because we were right on top of the ship. Then the decision was made who gets into the lifeboat, women and children first.
We should point out that many of the lifeboats were frozen to the deck, so they weren't even possible to launch.
Yeah, the the whole ship had 22 lifeboats, 11 on each side, and being it was minus 18 degrees Celsius outside, they only got about six loose, the rest were all frozen. Anyway, we were lowered into the lifeboat, in the lifeboat down, we were hitting the water, and all of a sudden they started to scream, "Who's got a knife? The ropes are frozen to the lifeboat. We can't get away." I remember what I told you earlier, the knife I stole from my uncle's trunk in Elbing. I gave it to a Marine, and of course those ropes are quite thick, so it took him quite a while to cut the ropes, but that's what I'm alive today, having that knife, and 60 people that we made it to, which is nice to know.
Inga, what did your mother do when the torpedo struck?
My mother said that we were both asleep, and she was flung from the bunk up against the wall. She looked around and I was still lying on the bed asleep. By the time the second torpedo struck, she'd gone to turn the lights on, only to find that the lights weren't on. They weren't. All the lights had gone out all over the ship. She opened the door and there was a dimly lit light lighting the passageway. And she went back and she got me and started to go up the stairs. Now, all over the stairs there were bodies. And my mother thought, why aren't they moving? Why are they just lying there, sitting there, staring? And the people behind her were pushing. And so she had to move and had to trample all over the bodies as everybody else did. And she made it up to the one flight of stairs, which was, I think it was divided between C deck and B deck. And she said already when she was on the second flight of stairs, there weren't quite as many people pushing behind her. And when she got to the top, she herself thought she couldn't go on and she was thirsty. Her lips must have been so dry. And she saw a lump of snow on the floor ahead of her. And she was able to bend down and pick that up, which proves that there weren't so many people around anymore. And she sucked on that snow and that made her feel so much better and she was able to continue. She, in the account that I have from her, she writes that at that stage, there really weren't that many people behind her pushing. They'd fallen behind. She got to the boat deck, opened the door to the boat deck. This was after she'd spent some time looking for her elderly parents who were in the theatre. Mm. I believe some people have described this as the ballroom, and I'm not sure whether there were two, but there were mattresses on the floor, and she describes it as a theatre. But her parents had long gone. The theatre had been cleaned out. The people had all gone wherever, I don't know. Mum made it to the boat deck. She opened the door and she was there. And at that stage, the boat was on about a 30-degree lean. And she couldn't get up that icy slope. There was a soldier at the top near the lifeboat, and that's where my mum wanted to go, to the lifeboat. Beside her, about a metre away, was an officer who was just standing there and staring to space, and Mum heard something that sounded like shots. And suddenly the officer came out of his dream and he said to the soldier, "Let us get this woman up here." And the soldier held one hand on the railing and the other one extended to my mother, and the officer was pushing us. You know, Mum was carrying me the whole time and I was 2 years and 1 month old, so I wasn't a small baby. And we got to the top of the railing and were told to get into the lifeboat. As we were getting into the lifeboat, they were letting down another lifeboat beside ours and it capsized and all the people just fell into the sea.
I should point out to the listeners at this point that Eva Horsteninger all leave Germany after the war to live in other parts of the world. And although they were survivors of the worst shipwreck in history, they weren't able to talk about it. In Eva's case, she marries a Jewish man called Rothschild. They immigrate to the US. They live in New York for decades before moving to Switzerland. And Eva doesn't want to tell or go into details of her experience with her family because, well, they had Jewish friends who'd suffered more in concentration camps. And in your case, Inga, you were the only one your mother could speak to.
That's correct, yes. She never, ever found anybody who knew anything about the sinking of the Wilhelm Gustloff.
Your mother never found another survivor?
Never. Yet I was so surprised in the book written by Mr. Selwood, The Damned Don't Drown, my mother's account of her survival clearly written about, and I will never know how he got that account.
That is a mystery. That's
very strange, a total mystery. A total mystery. And somebody, my mother must have told somebody her story, probably immediately after this, maybe in the Red Cross camp where we were for, I don't know how many days, maybe one night or more. But the story must have been told by somebody else to this author of that book.
But Inga, the other interesting thing is there were times when she almost wanted to tell the story, but people didn't believe it.
Exactly.
You talk about a social gathering where people are talking about the Titanic.
Exactly.
And your mum says, I was in a much worse disaster.
Yes.
And she's discounted and faintly ridiculed.
Yeah. Yes. People turned around and sniggered and laughed. And it happened two or three times. I was there, I can remember. And in the end, she said to me, I will no longer discuss this with anyone except you.
And she'd weep when she told you about it, wouldn't she?
Oh, every time, yes.
Horst, yes. Tell us a little more about that amazing gathering for the 50th anniversary of the sinking.
Well, I had the opportunity to be invited by Heinz Schön to take part, and a few days before I left Canada to get there, I got an email saying, would I sit at the head table? So I emailed it back saying, yes, I would. And then I had the fortune to sit with Eva at the head table. We were like brother and sister. Anyway, I made my speech and how I fled and how I got rescued and how I got picked up, and I told him the story of after I got put into the machine room, the engine room on the Leuva, the marine maid asked me, is there anything you would like, son? And I said, yeah, I'm so hungry, can I have a marmalade? Which he was able to get me, and I met this gentleman 50 years later at that at the anniversary, and he talked about it. He says he kind of remember me. He said, oh God, he says, you were so great and so thankful that I gave him the marmalade and sandwich. He says, you ate about half of it and all of a sudden you started to cry. And he said, you were asking, yeah, where's my mom? Because, as you know, the law of the sea is that children come out of the lifeboats first and then the grown-ups. And then mom got picked up. Of course, she didn't know where I was. And so she asked Marine, have you seen my son? And they said, well, how old is your son? And my mom said, well, he's about 10. And he said, well, there are some kids on buckboard. Let's go and take a look. So they went to the front of the ship, and he lifted up a tarp, and these children were dead. So, of course, mom went just about nuts, pardon the expression, not knowing where I was and not being there. And so she looked and looked, and she eventually did find me. So I must say, too, when we were in the lifeboat, I saw the ship sink. I had to face, like, west, and the Gustloff was behind me, and all of a sudden they started to scream, "Look at the Gustloff, it's all lit up." So I had to turn around and watched it. For some reason, all the lights went on the ship, and then within minutes, it was all gone. She went down.
Dark so forever.
I will never forget that.
Klaus, I know you've attended anniversaries of other sinkings, the Titanic, the Lusitania, but the 50th anniversary of this event was particularly affecting for you.
Well, I've partaken in many Titanic conventions, and the luckiest time was back in 88 in Boston when I think I met 9 survivors. So I was not prepared for what I was going to partake in when I came to this place, Ausibad Dump, which is north German coast at the Baltic. I had talked the Swedish radio into providing me with a tape recorder so I could make a radio program about it, which I later did. And there were about 200 survivors and people from the rescue ships. And I was literally walking around in living history. It's taken me many years to understand this kind of shock I was under later on. I didn't realize how privileged I was to meet and get to know Horst and Eva, for example. They have become very, very good friends of mine, and I've been visiting with Eva many times.
Time just disappears, doesn't it? When you listen to Horst, to Eva, to Inga, those years just absolutely evaporate. And Eva, the thing I find remarkable about you, or one of the things I find remarkable about you, is in the years since this horrible event, you have been on countless ocean voyages, including a trip on the QE2 to the Arctic Sea.
Yes, and many. And I was always afraid of mines or something, and my husband told me, "Don't worry, the war is over." But I still was always afraid. But I always had to be on the upper decks so that I could go out and be in fresh air and see the water and be sure that nothing happened.
Mm.
I think this will always stay with me.
And, of course, the reason you're on boats is because your late husband hated flying.
Yes, that's right. So we went on every beautiful cruise ship, cruiser. I mean, mostly crossings. We made cruises too, but crossings we made, most of them. We started with N55, and there I was always afraid that some mines are floating around from the war. But thanks God, nothing happened, and we had beautiful cruises.
Mm. Inga, have you had the chance to visit the site of the Wilhelm Gustloff, or have you had any desire to visit it?
I'm getting the desire right now. Up till now, probably not. To go there on the 30th of January wouldn't be very easy for me because it is very cold. So if they had another reunion, I dare say I would do it, but the weather would be hard to take.
What's it feel like to revisit the subject now, these events together? Do you feel very close to each other?
I feel privileged to be able to speak to the others. I think it's just wonderful.
Yeah. Do you have nightmares about it, Inga? Does it rush up into you when you least suspect it?
No, I don't. Probably because I truly don't have a memory of it. That would help me. You know, if you had have gone through that yourself and seen what Eva and Horst have seen, I'm sure you'd have nightmares. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, finally, Klaus, as we've said, this was the worst tragedy. There were the others we talked about at the same time in the Baltic. What is the status of these wrecks? Are they regarded as war graves?
Mm-hmm. They are regarded as war graves and should be regarded as such. But unfortunately, as Lee Bishop said, there have been plundering taking place, both by the Soviets and later on by other divers. And when I investigated and did the research to my book, I came across divers who told me, oh yes, it's not hard to get hold of artifacts from the Gustloff. And it turns out there is more than one diver, particularly in Poland, who have a lot of stuff from the Gustloff.
So the final question I have to ask you is, can you explain to me, now I know that two films were made on the story, I think a Polish film and a German film, and there's been quite a few authors who've tackled it. Why is it, however, that it has so little penetrated what one might describe as the collective consciousness?
The Titanic, as a comparison, sank when there was a low tide with news, and she sank between the two big news metropolises of the time, which was London and New York. Wilhelm Gustloff sank with no famous people aboard. There was no orchestra playing. There was no glamour. There was just people just like you and me who were trying to save what we could save, and in the end, the only thing you could save was your own life. Which, of course, I think is interesting and fascinating, and I was taken aback by the story because I'd never heard of it until in 1972, and then I started trying to find as much information as possible, and only realizing that it was only in Germany that there had been somebody writing about it considerably.
Mm.
So there are lots of different reasons. And then the other one is, the survivors were actually told they could not speak about the disaster. And in the new Germany, Bundesrepublik, nobody wanted to talk about disasters and accidents. Nobody. And first and foremost, up till now, any German has been not looked upon as a victim. This is important to remember that on the Wilhelm Gustloff, the people were victims. But it's always been said concentration camps or extinction camps, and that's it. It's not until now that it's been allowed to say that, oh yes, Germans too could suffer.
I think that's a very, very profound observation. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you very much. We heard the voices of Lee Bishop, the deep sea diver and shipwreck photographer, Klaus Göran Wetterholm, who's the historian and author, talking to us from Stockholm, and the three survivors, Eva Rothschild, Horst Voigt and Inge Rodecker. I thank you very much. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to get you all together. And that's a wrap for another week of Late Night Live. Thanks for listening.